I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect, and I am at a strip mall in Bellevue at a very special place. This is called Skate King. It is an old-fashioned skating rink, and when I mean old-fashioned, I kind of just mean old. It's got the original carpet from 1974. A lot of the skates date back to 1974. And the reason I'm here is that this is one of the last Thursday night skates, adult skates, in its 40-plus year run. Unfortunately, Skate King will be shutting its doors on June 30th. This is Skate King's final act. And that's what we're talking about today on Sound Effect. Final acts, last hurrahs, and last chapters. So I'm going to talk to just a few people here about what makes Skate King special to them and how they're going to feel when it's gone.
I'm Marianne Verlet. I live in Renton.
I'm Sharon Euster. It's E-U-S-T-E-R, and I live up in Everett.
I've been coming here since 37 years.
So, okay, how much has changed since those first period when you came here versus now?
Not a lot has changed.
In fact, some of the people who skate here are still the same people who I skated with in college.
My first friend here.
Did you guys meet here?
Yeah, we met here.
Sure did. There were times where the adult community was so strong here, and we just tore up the floor. I mean, it was really fabulous.
We all taught each other the same steps, so we'd get in a line and do like a line dancing with skates on. It was like a better place to go than to a bar.
Well, there's not that many places like that for like grown-ups to do things like that and have fun.
No, that's true. That's true. It's really a missing place.
My name is Lida.
How long have you worked here?
7 years.
What is the biggest seller at the snack bar?
Pizza.
Is it like frozen pizza from Costco?
Frozen pizza from Safeway.
Can I ask you one sort of sensitive question?
Yes.
One thing that a lot of people bring up when they think of Skate King is the smell.
It's the smell, yeah, that's for sure.
Do you still notice it because you come here all the time?
Well, I think I'm used to it, but when my dad around me, he can smell it. Everybody else can smell it on me. And I was like, what?
Like when you leave, you have it on you.
Like when I leave, I have it on me, yeah, that's for sure.
What are you going to miss about this place?
I'm going to miss the employees and the people, customers. Like, this is the best job I ever had.
My name's Alex. I'm from Auburn, Washington.
Alex Helms is one of the managers there.
I've been here for probably almost 7 years.
So when I came here for the first time, not that long ago, I spent the whole night trying to figure out, okay, this is either like a really elaborate retro job or it's just is like 70s era stuff.
It's really, it is a time travel back to the 70s, and that's because it was never updated. This place would be 300-400 more people in here right now if they would have just invested a little money into this place. If you look around, duct tape on the carpets from 30 years ago, the skate floor itself has not been replaced. Nothing has been replaced.
Yeah, like the vintage nature of it is kind of part of its charm, but it's also probably part of the reason that it's not as relevant as it might be.
Yeah, and we definitely are probably the oldest looking rink around here.
We bid bon voyage to Skate King in Bellevue as it goes into its final act. We are going to have a bunch of tales of final acts coming up on Sound Effect today. Final acts in life, in literature, in careers. That's ahead just after we sit down with some friends to talk over the week's news. Lots in store, so don't go away. We have assembled the Brain Trust here once again to help make sure that we go into our weekend fully up to date on the news of the week. This week, I would like to welcome Ashley Gross, who covers business and labor here at KPLU. Venice Buhayan is an editor at the Seattle Globalist, and Emily Parkhurst is digital managing editor at Puget Sound Business Journal. Hey, everybody, welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
So this week, we saw two Seattle City Council members introduce a resolution to seeking to pave the way for the city to possibly impose rent control. And there's a lot of things that would have to happen in order for that to actually come true. But this seems like one of these issues that is going to be a big campaign issue. We're going to be hearing a lot about it. And this seemed like a good time to sort of figure it out and help tease out some of the issues that are buried in there and unpack it a little bit. So first of all, maybe we could just define rent control. What is rent control? Emily Parkhurst, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So rent control basically sets limits on how and when landlords can raise the rents. Once you're in an apartment, basically the rent will stay more or less the same. It might be set to increase based on inflation or something like that. But once you leave, that landlord can raise the rent and most likely will.
So, but this would prevent just this sort of month to month, like, hey, guess what? Your rent's going up $200 next month kind of a thing.
Exactly.
So that seems like a common sense sort of a regulation seen from one point of view. But a lot of things would have to happen in order for it to actually become policy in Seattle. And Ashley, what are the dominoes that would have to fall?
Well, there's a state prohibition against it right now that's been in place for decades. And so the legislature would have to vote to lift that prohibition and let cities regulate rents and allow rent control laws to pass. So we're talking about a divided legislature, can't come up with a budget. Is this going to happen? Is this going to be top priority for them to figure out soon? Question mark.
Not to mention that Seattle-specific issues in Olympia tend to be kind of polarizing.
Right. We don't have a ton of supporters from, say, Eastern Washington.
Well, Venice Behind, what do we know about whether rent control works, whether it does what it sort of sets out to do?
Well, so I don't have any actual data. I have anecdata. And I have friends and family who live in rent-controlled cities, like New York City is one and San Francisco is another one. And I think the way that it's seen to play out there by people who rent is that it helps the people who have already been established there, but it doesn't do a lot to help people who are newcomers. So if you're kind of new to the area and you try to move in, you're kind of hit with sticker shock because the rents are so high. They're trying to make up for the fact that some of the renters are at these kind of controlled prices.
Yeah, and Emily, you've done quite a bit of real estate coverage. What do developers and other real estate business interests think about this policy?
To say that they're opposed to it would be a bit of an understatement. They're absolutely opposed to it, and I think the main reason for that is, these huge new apartment towers are expensive to build, and they want a return on that investment. If the rents are capped, their return is less likely to come as quickly as they want it, and they'd be less likely to build. I think at the same time, we're also looking at a possible tax on development that's being proposed, and if you combine that with a rent control measure, that could limit development. And if we limit development, we have fewer apartments. Demand and supply laws apply.
This is the perennial question that whenever any of these affordable housing things come up, the warning is that this is going to slow down development or disincentivize development. But just from the outside, it seems like, my gosh, development is so, it's such a hot market right now. There's so much money in it. Would anything really put the brakes on that, short of like a really draconian policy change? I mean, would we really see developers saying, well, Seattle doesn't seem like it's going to turn a profit anymore?
I completely see that. You look at all the cranes on the skyline right now, and it's hard to imagine that slowing anytime soon, especially with Amazon hiring about as fast as they possibly can. But all it takes is one little economic slowdown, and suddenly we have a glut of apartments on the market, and that could absolutely slow development.
Is it possible that we could see rent control, not complete blanket rent control where every single rent is capped, but something more limited or more specifically targeted towards certain kinds of properties? Ashley Gross?
Lisa Herbold, who works for Nick Licata, council member Nick Licata, and she's running for a city council seat herself, she put forward some things that I thought were pretty interesting that didn't occur to me as rent control. For example, say limits on raising the rent in winter a lot when people would have a harder time, say, finding a place to live or moving. Or limits on raising the rent when there's code violations. Those sound pretty, logical.
All right, well, that's our top story. I'm here joined by Ashley Gross, Venice Buhayan, and Emily Parkhurst on Sound Effect. Now we're going to move into our underreported stories of the week. And Emily Parkhurst, let's begin with you. What is your undercovered story?
My undercovered story of the week is actually kind of a feature story that we have been covering now for about a year. The company Juno Therapeutics, which was 2014's largest IPO out of the Puget Sound region. It's a company that spun out of Fred Hutch, and what they make is a cancer treatment. And they recently released results of their early trials, and it's a 91% remission rate for leukemia patients, which is pretty astounding. And these are the patients who basically chemotherapy and radiation did not work for them. And this particular type of cancer treatment does. And it's pretty astounding. The stock price went crazy when they announced that result. It was really impressive. And when you look at the data that they've presented from their trials, it's truly impressive. The next question will be, how expensive is the drug and whether it's affordable. But in the meantime, The results are really astounding, and we're just not seeing that much coverage of this company.
Do you think that people are leery because of various sort of biotech hype bubbles that have happened and popped in the past?
For instance, Dendreon?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people are right to be wary there. You know, having looked over some of the results that they've presented, this is not your grandparents' cancer treatment here. What they do is they take the healthy cells out of your body, they train them how to attack the cancer, and then they put them right back in. And it's really astounding technology. It's called immunotherapy. It's the next big thing, and we've got a big company doing it here.
All right, Juno Therapeutics, potential breakthroughs in cancer therapies. That's Emily's undercovered story of the week. Hey, Venice, how about you? What is your undercovered story?
So my undercovered story is the story of Renton resident Nestora Salgado. So she's been in a Mexican jail for the past 2 years. She went back to her hometown in Guerrero, Mexico, to help out with her community. She started a community police force. And that was going well until she arrested a local city official. And then in response, she got arrested and was charged with organized crime and kidnapping. That happened 2 years ago, and her family has been rallying for her release. So she's become a little bit of a cause celeb in Mexico. And the governor of Guerrero has called for her release. And also Congressman Adam Smith has been advocating for her release as well as different journalists and writers down in Mexico. So she recently went on a hunger strike, and as a result, she was moved to from a maximum security prison with very little contact with her family and her lawyers to a local jail with a medical facility. She calls her family every night now and has more access to her lawyers and sees her supporters outside. And I think that it's interesting that this case hasn't been getting a lot of attention, you know, especially given how much attention was given to the Amanda Knox trial from Italy. You know,
that's an interesting parallel. It lacks certain aspects of the Knox trial's media appeal, right?
I think so. I think that I do question, like, if it's not as salacious as the crime that Knox was accused of. Is it because Nestora Salgado's older? She's in her 40s. Is it because she's an immigrant? I mean, we find the story. So the Seattle Globalist has been covering the story. We find it interesting because of the kind of implications of political corruption, perhaps, of somebody going back to their community and doing good. You know, and being punished for it?
Well, the continued incarceration of Nestora Salgado, Renton resident in Mexico. Thank you, Venice Behind, for that undercovered story. And Ashley, let's bring it on home. What is your underreported story?
Well, there was a flurry of stories this week about the feasibility of Seattle creating its own municipal broadband network and the cost of it and whether it really is something that Seattle could undertake. But within all that coverage, I was surprised that there was no mention of Tacoma's municipal broadband network, CLIQ, which the News Tribune has done a very good job of covering extensively. And the issues there, they say that Tacoma Public Utilities says it's losing money and they're exploring a lease of it to Wave Broadband. And people in Tacoma are pretty outraged, and I think they feel pretty proud that they have a municipal broadband network. And, you know, experts I've spoken with have said it has lowered rates there to have a municipal service in addition to, you know, private competitors. And so I think it's just kind of myopic of Seattle media to not make mention of that or look into it.
To look at this very obviously well-matched comparison that is just an hour to the south.
I do think that it is interesting and timely because of the conversation going on here in Seattle.
Well, that's great. Thank you all for bringing your undercovered stories to the table here. I want to thank Ashley Gross, business and labor reporter for KPLU, Venice Buhayan, editor at Seattle Globalist, and Emily Parkhurst, digital managing editor at Puget Sound Business Journal. Hey, thank you all for coming back to Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week on the show, we're exploring final acts. And of course, the very final act for all of us living beings is dying. And it is on this cheery note that we have chosen to start this week's show. You might have noticed we are slightly fixated with death here on Sound Effect, but I would say probably the last group of people you'd expect to be really curious about it are little kids, right? They're so far removed from it. And yet, according to Jana Moore Lone, kids are really eager to talk about it. She is the founder and director of the University of Washington Center for Philosophy for Children. And as part of her job, she goes into classrooms all the time and has these kinds of conversations with kids. She's been doing it for almost 20 years. And so we invited her in to talk a little bit about kids talking about death. And I asked her how you even get a discussion like this started with a bunch of grade school children.
So the children can be anywhere from kindergarten age or even younger sometimes through high school. And there are many different ways we get the conversation started, although one of the standard ways is using picture books. And so it's nice to have a very safe and comfortable kind of setting with which to start thinking about the questions.
Well, there are a few more difficult topics than death and few sweeter ways to get into it than a duck.
So the book is called Duck, Death, and the Tulip, and it's by Wolf Erlbruck. So the story begins when Duck notices Death, who's a skeletal figure, standing next to him, or next to her, and Duck says, I hadn't noticed you before, and Death says, oh, I've always been here. And Duck says, why? And Death says, just in case. In case of what, says Duck? Well, you know, all kinds of things, colds, all kinds of things can happen to you ducks. And so we start to realize right away that Duck is probably somewhat near death, and that is why Death has come to spend time with Duck. But the book kind of proceeds in a somewhat surprising way because Duck and Death become sort of friends. And Death really obviously takes a liking to Duck. And at the end, when Duck does die, the book tells us that Death is almost a little moved. But that's life, thanks Death. And that's how it ends.
Wow. Sounds grim. So you brought this into a classroom of how old? How old were the kids?
Third grade. So roughly 9 years old.
How did they approach this conversation? Did they like the story? Was it something that they had any kind of vocabulary to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they did like the story. I think most of the students really liked the story. And part of the reason, I think, is that children think about death. And often when I ask students at the beginning of the year, what are some of the big questions you have? Many times death comes up. Why do we have to die? What happens when we die? What is death? Etc. Many of them, of course, have experienced death in their families or among people they know. And so it's a subject that children are very curious about, want to talk about, but often adults are quite reticent about raising the issue with children. And so bringing in a book, I mean, the way I do this, I bring in the book, but I don't say to the students, okay, we're going to talk about death. I read them the story, and then I ask them, what questions does this make you think about? And of course, in a book like this, often the questions are going to have to do with death, but they could, for example, have to do with friendship. They could have to do with, you know, what does the tulip symbolize? Why is the tulip in the story, etc.? So even though the story obviously has the theme of death, we might not necessarily go in that direction. So it gives the students a freedom to choose if that, in fact, is what they want to talk about.
So in this most recent classroom where you brought this book in, what do the kids want to talk about?
We spent most of the time talking about whether death had a special feeling for Duck. And in the context of that conversation, whether it was hard to be death, whether death liked death's job? Would it be, you know, an enjoyable job to kind of help people die? Is there a difference between death being responsible for people's deaths and death being just there to carry it out? Because one of the things the book points out is that death doesn't cause death, life does, right? He says, death says life takes care of those things, right? So the children wanted to talk about whether death could be a friend in a way, and which led to a kind of an interesting discussion about how to think about death. Should we think about death as a presence, or is death just a fact? One of the students pointed out in the conversation that death and life were so closely linked. He said something like, well, you can't have life without death. So death is always going to be a part of life. So it's not like death's the opposite of life. Death kind of is life.
So death is something that philosophers have been thinking about for thousands of years. And there's such a you know, many, many veins of tradition in philosophy of thought on death.
Mm-hmm.
What from that did you bring to the classroom or do you think sheds light on it that kids can understand?
That's a really good question. So I don't want them to think of philosophy as something adults do or something a lot of, you know, dead white males did for thousands of years or people who are only work in universities do. I want them to think of philosophy as something that they do all the time. And so I help them to think about these questions by maybe pushing them to go a little more deeply and probably draw on my own background in philosophy in order to see certain philosophical issues as they crop up.
Well, I know you said that the education you're doing is not about, you know, trying to fill the kids in on the Western canon of, you know, philosophical canon or whatever. But given that this is something that's preoccupied philosophers for so long, can you give us grown-ups a little tidbit from the philosophical canon, a way to think differently about death or to crystallize it a little bit?
Well, I think that most philosophers who have thought deeply about death focus on death's impact on life, right? The kind of what it means to live a mortal life. Asking questions like, if you could live forever, would you? And when we think about that question, we realize that living forever would mean not living in the way we live, right? It would be a very different kind of existence than a mortal life, because our lives are all about change and time and decay, right, from the moment we're born. And so death for us is so central to life that it's hard, and really in the words of the third grader that I taught last week, it's hard to imagine life without death. They're so tied together.
Well, Jenna Morlone is the founder and director of the University of Washington's Center for Philosophy for Children. And the book that she discussed with a group of third graders last week was Duck, Death, and the Tulip. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
You're welcome.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and here we are thinking about final acts this week. And the final act is, in a lot of ways, maybe the trickiest part of putting on a really effective performance. You know, it's what people walk away with and what they remember. And nobody understands that better than Ruben Van Kempen. He's been teaching drama and musical theater for 37 years, all in one place, at Roosevelt High School in Seattle. And Van Kempen is about to have his own final act because he's going to be retiring this month. When he was a teenager, his mindset was that he was going to be a star of the stage. What he's wound up doing instead was creating really one of the very top high school drama programs in the state. And in fact, he's considered one of the greatest drama teachers in the country. He's got shelves of awards. And true to form, for his final act, instead of playing it safe, he decided to go big. He is putting on the stage musical of Mary Poppins. KPLU's Florangela Davila tagged along to see how it all played out, and she brings us this story.
First things first about drama teacher Ruben Van Kempen. He's 63 years old, but he has very few wrinkles, and with his big smile, he seriously looks like, oh, maybe a man in his early 50s.
So the secret to looking youthful is teaching drama?
Absolutely, because you are energetic all day long. The kids keep you on your toes in more than one way.
We're at Seattle's Roosevelt High School. It's a few weeks before the annual spring musical opens. They're doing Mary Poppins. And what's happening all around Van Kempen is what the drama teacher likes to call organized chaos. There's a dance rehearsal to watch, a costume fitting to inspect.
And make sure the 2 points, the pinpoints, are on the side at your waist.
A German accent to critique.
Ab Banks, what objections can you possibly have?
Good, you've improved.
And hanging from wires way above the stage, there's a high schooler playing a chimney sweep, and he's flying and doing somersaults in the air.
Good! Isn't that way cool?
You know, your face totally changed. Before, like, walking in, your face looked really stressed, and now you look happy.
That's because I see something in action. Something's getting accomplished.
Is this your favorite part of the whole process, or is it the show in front of an audience?
The process is my favorite part, because that's where you can see where everybody's learning everything.
Ruben Van Kempen is one of the best drama teachers in the state, in the country even. He's been inducted into the Educational Theater Association's Hall of Fame and has received all sorts of accolades. During a recent musical theater class, I catch up with some of his students.
He's much more motivational and inspirational, I think.
He's a very patient, understanding person.
He's in his element, he knows what he's doing, and he's
wonderful at it.
That's Alexandra Montsier, Joel Curry, and Noah Foster Koth. Brenna Power, who's another one of his students, tells me.
He also has a good sense of humor.
I just come up with like five notes of some musical to answer their question. You know, somebody's talking and they say, oh my gosh, tomorrow. And I'll go, one day more. Or they'll go, it's raining. I'm singing in the rain. You know, and they go, oh, VK, stop. Oh, stop.
And if he had to pick his own personal theme song,
it would definitely be something that is, forget your troubles, come on, get happy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then you add tap dance to it, and we have it.
Have you always wanted to be a teacher, be a drama teacher?
No.
When he was in high school, he went to Queen Anne High in the late 1960s. Van Kempen told his drama teacher that he was going to be...
an actor. I'm going to be in that spotlight.
He studied theater and acting at the UW. Then one day, when he was a college junior, his dance instructor came up to him and said,
I just got a phone call from the drama teacher at Inglemore High School, and they're in desperate need of a choreographer for South Pacific, so this is a paying job. Do you want to do it? I said, me? I can't do this. She goes, yes, you can. So I went, and it was a very last-minute thing. The show opened 3 weeks later, and I just loved the fact that I could create stuff and collaborate with these young high school students, and they were just going, I can't do, oh, wow, I just did that. And that made me feel like this is where I want to be.
He's called Mr. VK, or just VK for short. He started at Roosevelt High School as a student teacher in 1976 and has worked here nonstop ever since. He shows up at 6:30 in the morning and stays past 5. He dresses like he should be in a magazine.
I'm wearing a purple V-neck t-shirt and green cords and patterned socks, which I love.
Oh, patterned socks.
I love
it. Are you stylish? Socks.
I try to be.
He's a perfectionist, and when it comes to putting on a performance, he's also meticulous.
So step over this and don't trip.
VK is showing me a part of the set that his actors will end up walking on.
One could be really simple and paint these platforms, which are floors, brown or black to match the stage floor and have it be it. Or one can be more detailed oriented and want them grained like with wood and then layered so that you see all these various wood colors on top of the graining. So
which takes a lot more time.
Which takes a lot more time, but it's also what I would consider my specific eye for detail that I want.
But this is high school.
Yes, but we have a standard. It's to live to the standard of what I would call on the edge of professional theater.
VK pushes his students to aim high because he says that lesson will serve them no matter what they end up doing in life.
You are solving problems together. You're creating things together. And then you can also then challenge yourself to be at a higher standard no matter what kind of job you're in.
In 2005, VK saw Mary Poppins on a London stage. He decided to bring it to Roosevelt, but had to wait 9 years for the production rights. He brought in an expert aerial choreographer. He hunted for months for the perfect red fabric for Mary Poppins' coat. And on closing night, his last production ever as a high school drama teacher.
I'm emotional and trying to not be. There are people like me in every state and all over the country that have poured their heart and have expertise, and I just feel very thankful and blessed that I'm in this specific community in this environment.
VK students have gone on to top colleges and professional performing careers, including Broadway. He figures he's taught 7,400 students during his 37-year career.
That story from KPLU's Florangela Davila. You can see a picture of the ever-stylish Ruben Van Kempen at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And as we continue our discussion of final acts this week, we now return to the subject of death. Rob Miller worked as executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington for most of the last two decades, up until about a month ago. And that organization helps people with end-of-life decision-making as they face incurable or terminal illnesses. And they pushed for the passage of Washington's Death with Dignity Act. So Rob found his way to this group because in 1994, 15 years before that law was passed, his partner was given a terminal diagnosis. His partner had pneumocystis pneumonia, which is a frequent complication for people who have AIDS. And part of that was Rob finding out that he too had been exposed to HIV. At the time, there weren't many drugs for HIV or AIDS, and in fact, they were both given a terminal diagnosis. So for the next 18 months, his partner slowly and steadily deteriorated, and the two of them talked about what was looming, which was death. His partner wanted to die at home, and he wanted to be in control of how and when that happened.
There are good ways to die and bad ways to die. Dying in your sleep, a good way. Having an accident, maybe, but cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, AIDS, these are diseases where the dying process can last a long time, and the suffering that a person experiences can be extreme.
What were your options at that time?
Well, this was pre-internet, understand. So naturally, I asked his hospice, and what they told me was the hospice philosophy is that we neither hinder nor hasten the dying process, and we can't really provide any information. I felt abandoned. We felt abandoned by medical providers. And it turns out that Compassion and Choices of Washington actually existed at that time. And we could have been referred to that organization, and they could have helped us understand the ways in which he could have shortened the dying process, like voluntarily stopping eating and drinking or stopping his medication. But we were never given that option. And after his death in February of 1996, my prognosis was very poor. I had taken care of him. My father had died of cancer a few months before my partner. And it, you know, looked like I was going down for the count.
Can you say more about what the experience of caring for your partner as he died, how that made you think about your own death at that time?
Well, it clarified to me what I did and didn't want. But at the point at which my line was reached, I made up my mind that I would end my life at that time, that I would not endure what my partner had endured or my father had endured.
What was the series of choices that you made having reached that decision?
I found out about Compassion and Choices of Washington, and I contacted the organization. I was interviewed by two of their volunteers and also founders of the organization, Shyla and Don Cook. And so Don Cook became my client support volunteer, and he helped me understand all of my end-of-life choices. And I made an informed decision to acquire a prescription for life-ending medication. And I have to say that on the day that I got that, it was a very good day. It felt like I had this huge weight lifted off my chest. It's like having insurance. You know, just because you get fire insurance doesn't mean you run out and burn down your house. I mean, you want that protection. You want that if things really take a turn for the worse and my suffering becomes intolerable, I can end that.
Well, obviously you didn't use it. How did that come to be?
Well, in 1996, better antiretroviral medications, or medications for the treatment of HIV disease, were finally developed and approved. And at that point, my health started to improve. The listeners can't see me, but I'm 185 pounds now. At that time, I was 148. So I was a stick man, and I started gaining weight, and feeling better, and was finally asked by Don Cook, my client support volunteer, if it would be okay if they made me inactive, which was a good day. I'm actually still a client with the organization. Even though I worked there for 15 years, I'm an inactive client.
Your file's at the back somewhere.
Yeah, it's there. I stumbled across it not too long ago and read the letters that I wrote to the organization.
What was that like, rereading those?
It brought back a lot of interesting memories of, where I was at the time mentally. But I feel the same way now. One of the things about death with dignity is that people who are extremely religious and devout and opposed to death with dignity, and they don't suddenly change their minds when they become a terminally ill person. They're still opposed to it, generally speaking. So one of the things that we know about death with dignity is that people who use the law have a long-held belief about that choice. And I'm one of those people. Like 15 years later, I still have this same belief that a person should be able to have control over some of the most important decisions that we make in our life: who we marry, where we work, where we live, how we die. I mean, these are things that are, to me, basic human rights, or should be.
Is the fact that there were these medical advances that brought you back from the brink and have extended your life by at least a couple of decades, is that an argument against giving people this choice?
The fact that I'm still here, that I had the medication for, 15 or more years, would seem to argue that I didn't jump the gun. And the truth is that, from working at Compassion and Choices for 15 years, I can tell you with no hesitation that people wait until they are very close to death before taking that medication. It isn't typically that people take it too soon. It's more often than not that they wait until it's almost too late.
You went on to become executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington in 2000.
What happened was my client support volunteer and one of the founders of Compassion and Choices of Washington, Don Cook, ended up becoming diagnosed with lung cancer and dying in 1999. And so it's kind of an ironic twist of fate that this person that he was helping to prepare to die ended up becoming the executive director of the organization that he founded.
You were at the head of the organization for 15 years, and then you just stepped down a couple of months ago. Why did you step down?
Well, I'm running out of treatment options with HIV disease. The virus can become resistant to medications, particularly with people like me who started with AZT in 1994 and then took the next thing and the next thing whenever it became available. I've become resistant to most of the medications available. And the only effective medication or combination of medication includes a drug called a non-nucleoside medication. And for a small percentage of people, it ruins their sleep. And nothing that I've been able to do has been able to mitigate this effect on my sleep. I haven't had a good night's sleep for over a year. Running a small nonprofit organization is intense. It's hard work. And I'm glad I was able to do it for 15 years, but towards the end of last year, I realized that I couldn't maintain. But I'm proud that I was part of the leadership of the Initiative 1000 campaign, the Washington Death with Dignity Act that passed with nearly 60% of the vote in all but 9 counties in Washington. And so I was really pleased to be part of that. And now to see how the law is working just as we said it would.
So after having been involved with this work for 20 years, very closely as anybody in the state of Washington probably, what matters to you the most about your own death?
When a person's dying, it's all about the person who's dying, right? I mean, the people are focused on trying to keep her or him comfortable and out of pain and manage the suffering. But the person who's dying also needs to take care of the people that are going to survive him or her. And one of the ways you do that is you wrap things up. You say, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I love you. I'll miss you. And if you can say all those things and really express yourself, you will leave those people with much more peace of mind and, more importantly, a peaceful heart.
Rob Miller recently stepped down as executive director for Compassion and Choices of Washington, which is the organization that helped pass Washington's Death with Dignity Act. Rob, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
It was a pleasure, Gabriel. Thank you for hosting me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and as we ponder final acts today, we thought that, you know, the idea of finality really resonates through a lot of the books that we love. It's this kind of very literary kind of sense to it. And so in that spirit, we have invited Amber Slavin to come join us. And she just goes by Slavin, and she's a public librarian at the Burien branch of the King County Library System. And she's here to share with us a few books by Northwest authors that cover this territory of finality or endings or final acts. So first of all, thanks so much for being on the show, Slavin.
Thank you, Gabriel.
So what was the first book by a local author that you thought of when we suggested this topic?
I immediately thought of Rebecca Brown's The Excerpts from a Family Medical Dictionary.
Is this some kind of a medical reference book?
It's not, actually. I think that the title is supposed to sound clinical, but it's much more of a memoir about her traveling to New Mexico to care for her mother who's dying of cancer.
So how does it play out? What's the book about?
Well, she travels from Seattle to New Mexico to care for her mother and describes her mother's life, talks about sort of the day-to-day things that go along with caring for someone who's dying, like taking her mother to a lawyer to draw up a will, caring for her in the hospital, waiting for her while she's in surgery, that sort of thing.
What do you like about this book?
Well, I fell in love with this book because someone read it to me over the phone before I lived in Seattle.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Does it lend itself to like reading aloud?
Absolutely, because Brown's writing is really poetic in a lot of ways, but also sparse and succinct.
So a book about death and a stark look at death, is this book a downer?
Oh, sure, certainly, and that's one of the reasons that I love it. yeah, I'm a big fan of music, movies, books that make me sad. Those are my favorites, so this is definitely one of those. This book in particular is very much about Brown's relationship with her mother, so sort of a mother-daughter relationship, and that really resonates with me. And then as someone who's lost people, I feel like the way she talks about bereavement and grief is profound and really right on.
Oh, that sounds gorgeous.
Yeah.
Well, okay, the book is called Excerpts from a Family Medical Dictionary by Rebecca Brown. And so, Slavin, you've managed to come up with two books about end of life, and not only about end of life, but kind of from the point of view of a home health worker. What is the second one you have in mind?
The second book is Jonathan Evison's The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. Jonathan Evison is a Bainbridge Island-based author. This book is sort of a sad sack, humorous, tender book about a man, Ben Benjamin, who has lost everything, and he's trying to pick up the pieces of his life.
And this is a novel. This is fiction.
That's right. It's fiction. Jonathan Evison, though, does on his website have a really beautiful essay about this book, and I think he pulled a lot of experiences that he had in his life to put in this book.
Uh-huh. So what is the story? What can you give us a... The bones of it?
Yeah, sure. Ben has lost his wife and his wife to divorce and then his children to a tragic accident, not in that order. So he's trying to pick up the pieces of his life, and he sort of starts that journey by taking a class literally called The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. And then his first patient is a teenager, I think he's 16, a 16-year-old paraplegic named Trev, who is perpetually horny and also very routine-oriented.
And what is it about this book that really struck a chord with you?
Well, admittedly, I really enjoy sad white guy books. I read a diverse range of books, but I do love a sad white guy. And I think this is one of those kinds of books.
I have been one myself at times.
Right? Yeah, maybe me too.
Okay, well, the book is The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving by Jonathan Evason, Bainbridge Island-based author. And the last book you selected is not a sad white guy book, if I'm reading it right. It seems like a bit of an outlier in that respect, but also it's got a whole different kind of tone, a different sort of mode than the other two. What's that book?
The Strange and Beautiful Sorrows of Ava Lavender by Leslie Walton. She's an award-winning author. This is her debut novel, and she's from the Pacific Northwest.
So this is a YA book, but do you think that it would appeal beyond just teenagers?
I do. I think that it has adult appeal, and it's a great book for young adults who maybe are really great readers or voracious readers and are looking for something with a little bit more, not difficult writing. It's maybe a little more advanced than some young adult novels.
It sounds kind of eccentric. Can you spiel the story?
It's essentially a fairy tale about the several generations of the Rue family with a focus on the women. The main character living in the present, which is actually 1950s in the Fremont neighborhood of Seattle. Her name is Ava, and she's 16 years old at the time of this book. She was born with a confounding set of actual wings like a bird that elicited religious fervor in some people when she was born, and that kind of carries out through the book too.
So this is not realism per se.
This is magical realism. So you readers definitely have to be on board for magical realism. I enjoy that definitely to a certain degree, but it does require a little bit of suspending disbelief. But I think Walton's writing is so great that it's easy to get on board with that.
Okay. And where does the final act stuff come in?
Well, it comes in play in some ways that I can't reveal.
Ah.
But there are also ghosts that literally haunt members of Ava's family, her grandmother specifically. So siblings of hers that have passed, who have died in different ways, sort of, they literally haunt her throughout the book and drive her crazy in some ways.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what is it about this book that pulls you in? What do you connect with it?
I really enjoyed the sensory details of the novel. There's a lot of, I think the author also does a good job of kind of describing Seattle in a way that feels exciting. And then also it's sort of a romantic kind of epic about a family. So I do enjoy an epic story, and this is definitely one of those.
Well, that title is The Strange and Beautiful Sorrows of Ava Lavender by Leslie Walton. And we're going to put a little reminder of all of Slavin's recommended reads at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Amber Slavin is a public librarian at the Burien branch of the King County Library System. Thanks for joining us to talk about final act books here on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad, with help from producer Matthew Stribe. And we want to take a second this week to welcome our new intern, Bree Ripley. Florangela Davila contributed reporting this week. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy, and we had web help from Mike Lewis. If you've got something to say about the show, you can leave us a quick review on iTunes and subscribe to our podcast while you're there, if you haven't already. And of course, come on back next week when we are going to hunker down for a full hour on the toilet.
There are groups of people we can consider restroom challenged. In other words, they need a facility either every hour at least or urgently.
You are not going to want to miss that one. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.